everybody, and welcome to the TCE podcast for August 2015. My name is Richard Janssen Parks, and today I am joined by TCE editor Adam Duckett.
Hello.
And senior staff reporter Helen Tunnicliffe.
Hello.
Over the next half hour or so, we will bring you a chat with John Perkins, a former ICMI president and chief scientific advisor to the UK government. We will be running through the latest supplement put out by TCE on consultants and contractors. And of course, we will be bringing you all of the latest news from the world of chemical and process engineering. First bit of news I want to talk about this month is every single issue that we put out in some way includes huge amounts of efforts to reduce carbon emissions, combat climate change and all that stuff, but this issue seems particularly stacked with it. There's been some really major movements in quite a few areas towards reducing carbon emissions and making the world a healthier place for all of us, especially penguins and polar bears, I think. I think both
as
of
anybody
you...
anybody living on a Pacific island.
True. I think that both of you wrote pieces on this, and there's been sort of breaking news since. So let's start off with Adam. You wrote your Catalyst editorial at the front of the magazine this month about how, we need to let engineers loose to combat climate change. So what's all that about? What's brought this sudden flurry of caring about carbon to the forefront?
Well, I get a little bit concerned that, I'm not going to answer the question directly here, I get a little bit concerned that people get a bit fatigued about this whole conversation about climate change, especially in the press, because I remember, and it was a long time ago, back in 2009, Helen and I were waiting for the Copenhagen meeting that was supposed to form a big international treaty where everyone was going to get together and agree targets for climate change
and actually do something?
Yeah, and the future was all going to be rosy and fantastic, and that was a massive flop.
Yeah, then and they just went, no.
I think ever since, unless you're in the scientific or the engineering press or the green trade press, or you're got a very left-leaning environmental agenda, someone like The Guardian, I think journalists just feel a little bit fatigued about this whole topic, that we keep getting told that it's important, but no one seems to be doing anything about it. And by all accounts, there's a huge meeting happening in Paris this December, which is kind of the sequel of the sequel of the sequel of the sequel of the meeting to Copenhagen.
Yes.
And the kind of the prevailing view now is it's now or never. Either we achieve something here or, well, we're in trouble.
We
really, really
what?
Big trouble. So I guess there's a lot of us looking forward to the Paris meeting, and as a result, there's been quite a lot of kind of related news in the build-up. I think one of the key pieces was your piece on the Apollo program that's been kind of suggested, which I know it isn't directly related to the Paris meeting, but it's formed out of that desperation that something needs to be done.
Yeah, exactly. It is totally formed out of desperation. The global Apollo programme has been proposed by 7 leading UK scientists and economists to try and just make people do something. And they've sort of costed it and worked it out and said, yeah, we could actually do this. They point out that back in the 1950s and 60s, the US spent $150 billion on the Apollo space programme.
Mm-hmm.
That is an awful lot of money.
Especially back then.
This isn't in today's money. That was just then. And they did indeed put several men on the moon,
mm-hmm.
which was quite exciting. We just had the 45th anniversary of the moon landings.
69, so 46.
69, 46th. Oh, and it was last weekend anyway. There was stuff all over Twitter. So they think that we need a similar global-style push of absolute focus and determination to make clean energy cheaper to produce than energy from fossil fuels by 2025. And they think it's possible. They think that they say that government spend just $6 billion on research into renewable energy. That's 2% of their total research and development spend. Compare that to the fact that they spend $101 billion on production subsidies for renewable energy and $550 billion on subsidies for fossil fuels. Fossil fuels. So they can't. These 7 scientists, who include Lord John Brown, former CEO of BP, and the author of the Stern Report, Lord Nicholas Stern, as well as Sir David King, the UK government's former chief scientific advisor, they've said that if we could just do something even similar to that, we might, this could really, really make a big difference. They think that all the governments in the world, anybody can join, everybody will be invited to join, should set up a big commission at some point in 2016, and will be expected to contribute around 0.02% of GDP from the years between 2016 and 2025. So
how much does 0.02% of GDP actually work out
well,
as?
From the G7 alone, that would amount to an annual contribution of $7 billion. That's just from the G7. And then if everybody else starts joining as well, this could be brilliant. Apparently a similar committee was set up for the semiconductor industry, and that has reduced the cost of semiconductors every year for the past 30 years, just because people got together, got determined, and started doing something. So, yeah.
It sounds like a perfectly sensible way of approaching this problem.
Mm. It does. It could work brilliantly if people would just do it.
If we look at kind of these successful programs, the Apollo-style program was, they just got, well, Kennedy's kind of put out a public target and said we'll be on the moon by 1969, and then turned around to his scientists and engineers and said, now make it so. So they had to kind of get together the best scientists and engineers they had, put them in a room and work out how to do it. That was a result of the Cold War. You look at the Manhattan Project, that was a result of, they were nervous about, you know, Germany were developing rocket technology, so they came up with their own nuclear program, put the best scientists and engineers in a room and said, develop a weapon. And I think this is the way that we need to combat climate change, is to treat it like a war, because, you know, we need to pour our best minds and all of the available resources we have at it, because, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, our lives are at risk, or those of future generations are at risk. It really does need a real focused effort.
So the aim of the Apollo-style plan is to make renewables much cheaper, but at the same time, there has been, in the past few weeks, there's also been a call to make carbon-emitting energy sources more expensive, and while that's been, you know, the call for many years from lots of people, the source for this particular one is one that you may not expect first time around, namely that it's from some of the world's biggest oil companies. The heads of six all European-based energy companies, including those of BP, BG Group, Eni, Shell, Statoil, and Total, sent a message to the UN in advance of these climate change talks later this year, basically saying we need a global carbon pricing scheme. That has to be something that we have to do, and that's something that even we, you know, people who potentially stand to lose money from this, at least in the short term, are entirely in favour of.
Global carbon price would enable them to look at their entire portfolio and say, that's going to be too expensive to develop, that's profitable, that's not, we'll focus our activities here, we'll stop doing this, we'll stop doing that. So
it'll also allow them to change their R&D budget, saying, okay, we're going to plow this much into CCS, for example,
yes,
or etc.
Yeah, certainty is key here.
I mean, I know that there was a lot of anticipation ahead of a Copenhagen as well. Everyone expected that to be something, and it really wasn't in the end, but there is so much support from so many different areas in the lead up to Paris. Was it some French diplomats, since we've gone to press, and French diplomats have sort of said, we really, really need to have something final and definite and real.
They've said we need something short and flexible, that we don't have to keep coming back to the table to negotiate every 5 years. Come on, let's get it right, and let's get it right now. ICME is one of, this has all happened since we've gone to press, so it's not included in the magazine, but it's obviously online. ICME has joined 23 other institutions from engineering and science and the medical world to say, Paris talks are your final chance. We actually need some meaningful action. I think, no, appropriate action, whether it's policy or technological, we actually need to do something now. Governments and politicians need to actually talk the talk as well as walk the walk.
We even had Arnold Schwarzenegger come out
yeah,
and be the, what is it, the official face of the bid to get something done.
Yeah, he's become the poster boy of climate change action. He said it's no longer science fiction.
Well, he would know.
He would know.
While the hopes for Paris remain high, there has been some evidence that international diplomacy can have a positive outcome. shown earlier this month when Iran signed a deal with some of the world's biggest powers, effectively ending the 12-year standoff over its nuclear program, which is good for a whole host of reasons, really. The negotiations with Iran were led by the US and supported by the UK, China, France, Russia, and Germany, who sort of represent some of the world's, well, biggest power blocks, I think it's safe to say. And the crux of the agreement is that the West, so the UK, the EU, will drop all of their ongoing sanctions on Iran, and in return, Iran will basically open up its nuclear program to pretty heavy inspections by the IAEA to prove and allow the West to be sure that they aren't trying to develop any nuclear weapons. So Iran gets a nuclear program that isn't hampered by sanctions and the threat of being bombed. The West gets the assurance that Iran isn't trying to build any nuclear weapons, and everybody gets increased trade and a general lack of icy diplomatic tension in the Middle East, which can only be a good thing, I think.
Absolutely. There was some big news around the actual stats, because when I first heard the story, I thought, is this going to be some kind of flimsy deal that doesn't amount to much? But from what I understand, from what you wrote, the figures are actually quite eye-opening. Like, the amount of activity that Iran is actually going to stop is quite significant, isn't it?
Yeah, they've agreed to ditch 98% of its uranium stockpile. They're going to dramatically cut the amount of centrifuges that they operate. They are going to stop all enrichment at one of their big nuclear facilities, and one of their nuclear reactors will be entirely redesigned so that it's impossible to produce a weapons-grade plutonium inside of it. So, yeah, and these are all fairly substantial steps, but even more than this, perhaps, is that they've signed these deals that allow the IAEA to send in inspectors virtually whenever they want. The IAEA.
Too many vowels.
Yep. said that they can basically ask to inspect a site on virtually any pretense, not one of pretense, on virtually for virtually anything that looks even slightly suspicious. If they get a satellite pictures of a hole in the ground somewhere, and they say that might be, a hidden nuclear facility, then they can be taken to go inspect it. If Iran buys some parts that could be that could potentially be used in producing a nuclear weapon, then the IAEA can demand to be shown the paper trail, find out where they went, what they're being used for, and all these things like that. So it should, at the very least, severely restrict any Iranian attempts to build nuclear weapons, assuming that they were trying to build them
in the first place,
which has long been a matter of debate. Our next story is so mad, I'm going to just leave it to Helen to introduce. Helen, go.
Well, I found a story about a way to make flu drugs with an espresso machine.
When you say espresso machine, you mean one of those things that goes, you get in restaurants that has handles and makes the hiss.
And yeah, the steam and the hiss, and the one that you get ground coffee and you put it in and you fill up the little tank with water and you press on, and 2 minutes later you have a cup of coffee.
Instead of a cup of coffee, you have a cup of drugs?
Yes, except that you start with star anise rather than coffee. Of course.
I feel there's at least one middle step here that I'm not quite understanding.
No. But I will explain more. There is no middle step. You literally just chop up your bits of star anise and put them where you'd normally put the coffee, and then fill up your little tank and press on. And then what comes out is something called shikimic acid, which is a precursor for Tamiflu, made by Roche. So shikimic acid derivatives have also been shown to have anti-cancer, antiviral, antibiotic, and anticoagulant properties. Perhaps I should start taking star anise. I have a bad throat, in case anybody can't tell. So because they've now found this really easy way to get all this quantity of shikimic acid, there'll now be lots more available for research. So this is a really nice, easy way to get more shikimic acid for, you know, drug development or whatever. It's easy, it's cheap, it's readily available, and all the previous attempts have been, you know, using really specialist kits rather than just a coffee machine.
And some star anise from local supermarket.
Some star anise from, yeah. It's great. So yeah, the shikimic acid they managed to produce, this is a guy, I should probably mention his name, is a guy called Jason Smith from the University of Tasmania in Australia. And they managed to make shikimic acid that was about 90% pure.
Did he at any point explain how they'd arrived at the idea of putting star anise into an espresso maker to make drugs?
It was just a guess. The way he said it is that they realised that making coffee with an espresso machine is basically just extracting organic things, organic molecules out of the coffee. And basically, shikimic acid is an organic molecule within star anise. So it stands to reason, if you put star anise in a coffee machine, you'll extract the organic molecules.
That is a mental leap. Ta-da! That I would not have taken.
But you're not an engineer.
That's true.
I'm not a research engineer.
So yeah, it's fab.
What a great story. Earlier this month, I interviewed John Perkins, who is a former ICMU president and has recently left post as Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK Government's Department of Business Innovations and Skills. And he talked to me about his time in office, what he's learnt, and how engineering institutions can do more to positively affect the world of politics.
Okay, so Professor Perkins, you served as the Chief Scientific Advisor at the UK Government's Department for Business Innovation and Skills for 3 years. What made you decide to take up the position?
It was an exciting opportunity, it seemed to me, to get involved in what I thought at the time and continue to think was a government department doing excellent work, particularly on industrial strategy. So having run large parts of universities for a decade or so, I thought it was a nice idea to get away from that and become an advisor, not having huge managerial responsibilities.
Okay. As our chemical engineer on the inside, can you give us a little insight on what a typical day as a chief scientific advisor might look like? What were your roles and responsibilities, and how did the government make use of them?
I'm not sure there's such a thing as a typical day. Every day was different. I mean, I sat on a number of committees working on various things. For example, you know, John Beddington's group looking at the future of nuclear energy in the UK. I gave informal advice to a number of colleagues on a whole variety of issues, cybersecurity, chemicals, deep sea mining in the oceans, a whole variety of things, and we had, you know, a major project on engineering skills, which was commissioned by Vince Cable, which you know I and colleagues in the office and in other parts of biz spent a significant amount of time on.
I was going to come to that actually, because to my mind, your biggest piece of work while in department seemed to be your review of engineering skills for the government. In broad terms, what were your main recommendations?
Well, there were 22 recommendations in the report. There were a handful for government alone. The remainder were about promoting collaborations to, if you like, sharpen up the delivery system for engineering professionals into the UK economy, looking at, you know, inspiring young people from an early age in schools to think about engineering and inform them about what engineering is like these days, looking at apprenticeships, further education and higher education as components of the system which delivers skilled professionals into industry with engineering skills. So, you know, I think the key elements of the recommendations were, first of all, the need for collaboration, that government on its own cannot improve the supply of engineering graduates or engineering professionals. It needs to work with industry and with the profession, and the industry and the profession need to be up for those that collaboration in order to increase the numbers. You know, Vince Cable asked me to look at whether there was evidence of a shortage of engineering professionals in the UK economy. There seemed to me to be enough evidence that, you know, we could usefully have more engineers in the UK, that we really ought to do something about that. So the main focus of the report was on the delivery system for future engineers.
Okay. If speaking directly to listeners, those that work within industry, is there anything specific that you would call upon them to do to help increase the number of engineers coming into the profession?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually. I mean, there's a huge amount of effort going into trying to inform and inspire young people in the education system about engineering, and that's been ongoing for many years, actually, ever since I can remember, probably, which is a long time. But there's a need, I think, for more strategic and coordinated effort in that regard. So I would encourage members of the profession, indeed, to engage in activities to inform and inspire young people about engineering, but do it within a coordinated and strategic approach rather than trying to do things on your own or in small local groups. I think this collaboration on a strategic level, I think, is key to success here, to increasing the flow of engineers into the UK economy.
Okay. That's dealing with perhaps the volume side of skills, getting enough people into the profession. Are there any concerns or particular areas where you think we need to improve on the types of skills that we're bringing to engineers?
Well, I actually think that the education system does a pretty good job in informing engineers at the beginning of their careers, be it through the apprenticeship route or through, you know, the graduate route into the profession. Of course, there's always room for improvement. And I think, again, a key to that is to encourage stronger engagement from industry in components of the education system. You know, providing teachers with experience of what modern industry is like, I think, is an important thing to be working on. I think providing work placements to students as they move through the education system is another place where industry can really play a major role. But there are a lot of companies that are not engaged in this kind of activity at all.
Yeah, just to, I guess, give an informed plug to anyone that's listening in, iChemy has recently produced some guidelines on how companies that are interested in offering student placements within industry can best do that. So they're available through iChemy's education special interest group, and I know a number of companies have been in touch to say they've found them very valuable. On the other side of things, we've had a lot of students come to us and say, if our university doesn't have direct links to industry, we find it quite hard to get industrial placements and find out which are available. So TC is hoping to launch a new jobs board within the coming month, and that will actually allow companies to post industrial placements for free on that job site. So hopefully we can actually do our bit as well and actually help link up students with industry. So I hear those complaints quite often, so hopefully iChemy and TC can help solve those problems.
I think you're absolutely, I mean, I think, you know, underlying the point you've just made there is the importance of professional engineering institutions in helping to address the issue of the shortage of engineers. You know, I think the professional institutions have a huge role to play in being a part of the solution to this.
Okay. We took a bit of a tangent there. What I really wanted to ask you after we discussed your report was, can you point to anything that's come out of as a result of your review that's changed or has improved, or is it too early to tell at this point?
No, I think, I mean, the immediate reaction of government was quite encouraging. I mean, they deployed of order £500 million of extra funding for various parts of the engineering supply system. So more money into higher education, money into apprenticeships, support for Engineering UK to develop the Tomorrow's Engineers programme and Tomorrow's Engineers Week, and so on. So that was an immediate response from government to the report, which, you know, and I think £500 million of investment is a good start.
Very good start, yes. Excellent. Okay, well, that moves quite nicely towards my next question. When I talk to readers and ask them about what they'd like to see more of from ICME and from TCE, one of the key things that they get, I guess, most passionate about is they want engineers through the likes of ICME to make and to have more influence on government decisions. How would you rate our profession's ability to influence government?
I think we're doing a lot better than we were a decade ago.
That's a very diplomatic answer.
it's just the start of an answer. I think the situation a decade ago, maybe more than a decade ago, was that we had of order 40 different engineering institutions, yes, which thought of their fellow engineering institutions as competitors rather than, you know, part of a bigger community. And I think through the efforts of the Royal Academy of Engineering and the leadership of the major engineering institutions, the situation now is a lot better. Engineering institutions are inclined to work together in order to address issues that the profession faces. And I think that's a major step forward. So through things like Engineering the Future, Education for Engineering, and so on, both of which have been orchestrated by the Royal Academy of Engineering, we're seeing a spirit of collaboration in the profession that perhaps is a new thing. Well, it definitely is a new thing, and it's really encouraging, and it's what's needed in order to make a difference on this issue of skills and numbers of engineers.
I do remember when I first started, there was a discussion around, I think, exactly that the professional engineering institutions were just too fractured, and that government requested that we all actually sing from the same hymn sheet, and rather than submit 40 recommendations all individually, actually get together and decide what the priority was for engineering itself. So, I think I've certainly seen an improvement from what I read as well. You've seen it from the inside. Is there anything else that dampens our ability to influence government, whether it's perceptions we need to overcome with ministers or civil servants, or perhaps other structural problems with how we work with government that need to be altered?
I think we're doing a much better job than we have done in the past, and that is through working together among the professional institutions. Of course, the previous administration was very keen on industrial strategy, which, you know, provided an obvious kind of route into government for the engineering profession, because, you know, to have an industrial strategy which doesn't think about the future of engineering is not to have an industrial strategy, as it were. So that helped enormously, I think. And BIS in particular put a lot of effort into establishing and maintaining strong links with sectors of industry and the professional bodies underpinning those sectors. And, you know, in almost all cases, the sectors that have been identified in the previous administration's industrial strategy involved engineering. And so inevitably, engineering came to be very important for BIS.
Do you think that the government position has changed at all? Do you think there's still that need to, or that desire to include engineers and take forward that industry strategy?
Well, it's too early to say. Yeah. I think the commitment to apprenticeships, I think, is encouraging. I mean, I do think apprenticeships are a key part of developing the skill set that this country needs in order to rebalance the economy. I hear the Chancellor talking about the March of the Manufacturers, which again is an encouraging sign, but exactly how that's going to play out in terms of government policy, I think it's still too early to make a considered judgment on that.
One of the I've only got a couple more questions to go. One of the things I'm interested to know is what do you see are going to be the big engineering challenges that are going to be coming down the road that the government needs to get a handle on? What do you think you'd be focusing on now if you were still in the role?
Well, I think energy continues to be a challenge for us all, really. I mean, not just for the UK, but globally. You know, how to maintain and indeed increase the supply of energy as developing nations develop, while not doing irreparable harm to the planet. This, I think, was something I was involved in while I was in BIS, and it's something that I think future CSAs and the government will need to pay a lot of serious attention to. Another, I think, big issue is infrastructure in the UK. You know, we're seeing investment in new infrastructure. That needs to continue, and we need to have the capability to deliver and maintain a top-class 21st century infrastructure for the UK.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to Professor John Perkins.
This month, TCE have published the 2015 Consultants and Contractors Guide, which is available for everybody online at the tcetoday.com website. Not only does it contain the listings that all our previous guides have finished, allowing you to track down the consultants and contractors that you need to carry out your job, it also holds a whole wealth of information on being a consultant and or a contractor, ranging from sort of the best tools to use through to what the average day is like for a consultant. Adam, you were sort of the driving force behind this. So we've been publishing the lists of consultants and contractors for several years now. Why this year did we push extra hard to get all this editorial content, all of these features and pieces? What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, I wanted something a bit more editorially strong, I guess. Previously, it's been rather editorial light and it's been more based on the listings, which I know are very helpful, but I think the guide should be used to actually help people perhaps do their jobs better or find new opportunities. And I was listening to very good webcast, which is run by ICME's consultancy special interest group, which I'd urge everyone to go online. It's actually a really, really vibrant community and they've got lots of very good resources online. And they were talking about, they do this Ask a Consultant webcast, which is, it's a panel of expert consultants who sit down and take questions from the audience. And one of the, they did like a snap poll, and the audience, I think it was a good proportion, it may have been something like 30 or 40% said they were interested, the reason they were listening to this webcast was they were interested in becoming consultants. And the reasons for that were fairly varied, but there clearly was a thirst for some insight on what it takes to be a consultant, some advice on how you succeed as a consultant. I thought, well, we've got the Consultants and Contractors Guide, and we should use this as an opportunity to help educate those people about how they can go about being consultants and give them some top tips on advice for being successful, how to stand out in a crowd. So that's where we kind of came from. So we've put that information into the guide. We've had experts write the pieces for us. So I'm hoping, really, that it just provides some very kind of practical information on how to succeed, not only as a consultant, but also as a contractor as well. I think this could be quite interesting for contractors to read at the moment. Obviously, a lot of contractors, and especially in our readership, working in the North Sea, will be facing very difficult times. We've got an article, it's an interview with NES Global Talent, their director, Mark Ballard, who talks about the fact that with contractors facing such difficult times and so many of them being made redundant or being put on less hours, there really is an opportunity for them to move into different areas. And consultancy is one of them. So there'd probably be quite a lot of consultants, contractors out there at the moment that are considering a slight career change and thinking of going it alone. So not only do we discuss the opportunities for contractors on how to pep up their CV, which areas they should focus on for maximum success, but if you're in that difficult position where you think that perhaps the North Sea, the oil industry isn't the right place for you at the moment, there's some good advice in there on making a career change as well.
Well, that's it for the features we're going to be discussing this month, but this is where we talk about anything interesting or unusual, exciting we found online that we can point our listeners towards. Helen, I think that you were saying that there was something that you found earlier this month that was really rather cool.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite stories ever, actually. I'm sure I've said that sentence before in the podcast, but this one is.
Potentially. Room in your heart for lots of favourites.
Yes, there is. But anyway, there is a civil and environmental engineering professor at Stanford University called Mark Jacobson. And together with all his colleagues, he has compiled individual roadmaps of how every single state in the US could use 100% renewable energy by 2050. Yeah, you're all going, this guy makes it sound so plausible. They've literally looked at every state individually. They've set up this incredible online website. Well, you know what I mean. thesolutionsproject.org, which is well worth a look. It's an interactive map, so it gives you a visual explanation of all the solutions they've found for each state. So they begin by looking at the energy use in each state in residential, commercial, industrial and transport sectors, and then look at the source of the fuel and calculated how much extra power would be required if all those uses were converted to electricity. So from that, they could then work out how much that they needed to power cars, and they've sort of assumed that by 2050, homes and industry would have electric heating and cooling systems. And they actually think that the energy demands would fall by 39% by 2050, you know, just with all the kind of technological improvements. So I think actually the main barriers are social, political and industrial, you know, getting people to change. It's going to require a huge mindset change. But this map is just one of the best things I've ever seen. So it's definitely well worth a look. If you've got a bit of time to kill, you need to look at thesolutionsproject.org because it really is full of solutions. Very exciting.
Have we got anything else? Any webinars planned or anything like that?
No, but as well as being on this podcast, I listen to, and I believe Rick does as well, listen to quite a lot of podcasts in my spare time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to one by a organisation called TWIT, which is This Week in Tech, and they do lots and lots and lots of different podcasts. And one of them is a show called Triangulation, where they speak to like an expert in a certain area to do with technology. And they've spoken to a guy called Robert Stone, who is a documentary filmmaker, who filmed the documentary, would you believe it, called Pandora's Promise, which is all about nuclear power. And this documentary filmmaker used to be completely anti-nuclear. He was in the 70s, he was one of those people kind of on the picket lines, kind of demonstrating against the rise of nuclear power. And he's since turned completely his views around and believes that nuclear power is the future. And it's just really, really interesting to listen to someone that has changed their worldview and has been out and spoken to people around the world, from those involved in the accidents at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and Fukushima. And some of the stats he gives are quite impressive, such as, if we were just to guess around this room, how many people do you think have been killed by nuclear power in the last 50 years?
So including accidents attributable, like,
yes,
increase in cancer?
Yes.
It's something, I did know the answer to this, it's something vanishingly small.
I'm guessing
directly attributable
sub 50?
About 50.
50.
Yeah.
It is about 50. If you were to take all of the deaths caused by fossil fuels in the same amount of time, have a guess.
Tens of thousands, I'm guessing.
I'm going to guess
a coal mining?
Several million.
According to you, I think it's according to UN estimates, if you take in the likes of particulates and people dying early from breathing trouble, it kills about 3 million people a year. So 150 million people have had their lives ended early by fossil fuels in the same amount of time that nuclear power has killed 50 people. And that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to discuss the kind of the fears of radiation, which I know Helen has discussed a great deal in the past, versus what we're kind of used to and how those two things balance out.
Right, well, I think that's about it for this month.
So this could... Are we still recording?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this could actually be our... I don't know, our... not last podcast, but a last podcast in a little while, because... Tell us the good news, Rick.
I am moving on. I've got a new job starting in a few weeks' time. It's all very strange.
So our podcast chair is off on his way. So this might be the last podcast that we were able to record for a couple of months. But hopefully we'll be back soon.
We will find a way.
Yes,
I certainly hope so. we've bought this mic now already.
So, I don't know, I guess if you need to get in contact with us now, it'll be, you can either email me on aduckett@icanme.org, or you can tweet us at TCE Today.
Yep.
And that still works.
Facebook is www.facebook.com/TCE Today.
So, yeah, I guess that's... this is where I'd normally say see you again next month, but that's not true, so... thank you very much for listening to me over these past few months. That's a goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
It's a wrap. Goodbye.
Bye.